From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The Natural Resources Defense Council, a conservation group, released a study last week with some sobering news for the nation's winter sports industry. According to their analysis, downhill ski resorts have lost over $1 billion from 1999 to 2010, with ski visits down 14% here in Utah. The cause? Low snow totals. They conclude that climate change is having some real economic consequences for the industry. And they say that without intervention, winter will warm another 4 to 10 degrees by the end of the century. Today on the program, we're talking about the economic costs of a warming climate and what can be done about it. Plus, 30 years of the Baroque master Vivaldi by candlelight. All that in your calls after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Today's cold and snowy conditions here in Utah are a skier's delight, but winter is coming later, and spring is coming sooner, and this warming climate will devastate the bottom line of the nation's ski industry. That's according to an economic study released by the Natural Resource Defense Council and Protect Our Winters, another environmental group. The study states that the nation's $12 billion winter tourism industry is in jeopardy by rising temperatures and less snowpack. And today on the program, we're walking through the study and what it means for Utah's resorts and the hotels, the retailers, the restaurants, the gas stations that all rely on Utah's greatest snow on earth. Joining me in studio is Brent Giles. He is the Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation, the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort and eight other resorts throughout the country. And he joins me in studio. Brent, good morning. Thanks so much for the time.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Also joining me by phone is Lori Johnson. She is chief economist at the Climate Center of the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group with over 1 million members, joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. And Lori, welcome. Thanks so much for your time as well.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Later on in the program, a musical tribute to Four Seasons. But first, winter and tourism. Locals, does your business rely on the fluffy white stuff? How worried are you about the long-term effects of climate change? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Lori Johnson, I'll start with you. We'll get to the specifics of this study as we go, but just briefly, what is the bottom line of this report?
Well, the bottom line is that the ski industry is facing problems already, and we can definitely expect that it will be facing more. And so what we'd like to do with this report is highlight those concerns, but also bring to the attention of everybody all the solutions and the things we need to do that we can do to deal with our carbon pollution.
So that's why the Natural Resources Defense Council decided to do this study, to raise the red flag?
I think the more we actually understand all of the economic impacts, ski industry is one of many, the more people will see how important we have very smart economic policies that make a lot of sense economically, but also to protect people's livelihoods in and of themselves for people. So it's part of the whole package to really see what's happening.
Some may say, why associate this with climate change? Why not the temporary dip in snowpack? Just look at part of a cycle in temperatures.
Sure. There's always natural cycles. But what we have noticed is that if you just look at a survey of ski resorts, for instance, they are opening, about 50% reported opening later and also closing earlier. And the weather trends are exactly what the science has been telling us we should be expecting. So while you can't attribute any particular event, of course, to climate change, we do know that climate change will be exacerbating any of those natural events in and of itself. There's also, well, if you look at our study, we had 38 states that are involved in ski and winter industry tourism. So 35 of those also, over 35 total had these impacts that we found. So it's part of a very general pattern.
Brent, the study states that climate change is expected to have severe negative impacts on the winter tourism industry. Clearly not a rosy outlook for your line of work. What's your take?
Well, I agree with that, absolutely. Park City Mountain Resort and Powder, they commissioned a climate assessment in 2006 and again in 2009. And it's pretty evident that if the science is true, which I see no reason that it won't be or isn't, that we will have reduced snowpack. And as far as economic impacts, why, it stands to reason. Less snow, less money. The economic impact to the Park City area, specifically depending on the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, high emission scenario says that by the year 2100, we could lose $391 million in the economy because of lack of snow.
So this is big for you. You don't think that the assessment is overly pessimistic? In this assessment from the Natural Resources Defense Council, it says Rocky Mountain snow depth in winter, that's December to April, is expected to drop to zero.
In 2100, depending on what the greenhouse gas emissions are. Now, the good news is that between now and 2100, the severity of that can be decreased by things that we do to reduce our carbon footprint. And that's where we need to advocate for, if it's a carbon tax or whatever laws it will be, we need to be very active in making that happen because we can reduce it.
Speaking with Brent Giles, he's the Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation. It's the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort. Also with us, Lori Johnson, Chief Economist at the Climate Center for the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's an environmental group that issued a report which shows the economic impacts of climate change on the winter tourism industry. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments for either of these folks, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Lori Johnson, describe the winter sports industry for us. According to the report, you say between 2009 and 2010, more than 23 million people participated in winter sports and recreation. That's big business, right?
Yes, it's a huge business. The national estimates that we had for the losses in the particular years that we looked at was about 15 million skier visits, which corresponds to about $1 billion of resort revenue and about 27,000 jobs. So it's a very big contributor to people's livelihoods, but also to how we live our lives and the benefits and joy that we get from nature and the wonderful things that it gives us.
And you're not just pardon me, you're not just looking at ski resorts, right?
Well, we also looked at snowmobiling, which is much harder to actually get a handle on because the data is, they don't have these businesses that are collecting revenues and all the statistics. What we were able to look at was the number of registrations, and that has been changing. And particularly with the snowmobile industry, they don't have an option of actually making more snow, which at least resorts have that, but that's also very difficult with the changing temperatures. We have to have freezing at night. You also have to have an incredible amount of water, and we've seen record droughts this past year, but also in the last decade, there's been a fair amount of drought as well. And in Utah, in 2002, every single county qualified for disaster relief from drought. So resorts, one thing they can do is diversify the services they provide, and they have started to do that, things like conferences and alternative recreation that people can come and do. But it's not a foolproof strategy, and it doesn't make up for a lot of the losses. It's just sort of a way to mitigate those damages.
Brent Giles, the report notes that Utah ranks fifth in the nation in the amount of money that winter tourism adds to the economy. So it's not just big business nationally. It's huge here in Utah, adding about $744 million to the state's economy.
It is a huge industry in Utah. And echo what Laurie says, as far as the snowmobiling industry, the skiing industry, and it does not stop there. Because, you know, as we have a lack of snow, lack of moisture, I mean, that's common sense. If you have less snow, those sports are going to go downhill. So to mitigate that, a lot of the resorts have increased their summer operations to try to take care of some of the losses you might see in the winter. But more so is, you know, as we look forward to 2100 or 2075 or whatever year we want to pick, is that it's the loss of all of that water, all of that snowpack that feeds our watersheds. And it becomes more of a question of snow is water and water is life. And so we have to open our eyes and be a little more broader with the perspective than just the winter sports. It's going to be hit extremely hard. And the call to arms for all of those folks that enjoy the winter sports is a great thing for this NRDC and POWW study to bring. So I just hope that the focus increases.
What does all of this mean to the region, do you think?
Well, as the climate assessment that we did stated, by 2100, again, the Park City region could lose $390 million. That's almost 4,000 jobs as well. So the impact is extreme, not just for the ski industry. But we must remember that we also live in a desert, and we need snowpack, and we need to reduce our carbon footprint personally, commercially, and politically. We have to be able to make some changes.
Speaking with Brent Giles, he is the Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation. It's the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort. Also, Laurie Johnson is with us. She's the Chief Economist at the Climate Center of the Natural Resources Defense Council. They are the group that issued a recent study on the economics, the economic impact of climate change. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about climate change and what it could mean for Utah's ski and winter sports industry. You can join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've got questions or comments about snow totals or what policies you think could help, 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Skiers, snowboarders, snowshoers, snowmobilers, all are thrilled with the big fat flakes falling from the sky throughout northern Utah today. And the resorts, the restaurants, the winter retailers that depend on the snow are equally thrilled. But the winter sports industry has reason to worry about its long-term viability, according to a new report. The environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council says climate change has already cost the industry over $1 billion, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. Today on the program, we're talking about the economic fallout of a warming climate and how resorts and others in the industry are responding and how policymakers should respond. Joining me is Laurie Johnson, Chief Economist at the Climate Center of the Natural Resources Defense Council, which issued the report. Also, Brent Giles, he's the Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation, the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort. And we invite you to join us as well. If you can tell us about your ski visits, have they gone down in recent years? What do you think local resorts and, more importantly, policymakers can do to protect the livelihoods of those who depend on the snow? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Brent Giles, how has climate change been affecting snow conditions at Park City Mountain Resort?
Well, I've worked at Park City Mountain Resort for 34 years, going on 34 years. And I have seen a lot of change there. In the early 70s, around 76, I guess, we saw quite a drought. I remember Christmas Day, there was hardly any snow on the ground. And the call to arms for climate change and things we were doing started around 1970. So as we saw these changes starting, we started noticing that we needed something to increase our ability to open for Thanksgiving, have a good experience by Christmas. And so snowmaking started. Before the 70s, there was no snowmaking. And so this has been a response, a way to mitigate climate change ever since then. Even though we may not have said, oh, it's climate change, the bottom line is it was the same effect. You know, we were starting to see colder temps and our season stretch, the opening, go further and further into the fall. So the first mitigation that was done for climate change before we even knew it really or accepted it was to start making snow and then to start increase summer operations. There's a lot of other things that can be done, but reducing the carbon footprint at the same time as you work on taking care of reducing the carbon, you know, we may not see the effects in 2030, might be 2050 before we start really seeing some definite effects of climate change, harsher effects of climate change. But the thing is, if we haven't started to reduce that carbon now, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, then in 2050 we're going to be having this same conversation. And that's just unacceptable.
Lori Johnson, I imagine this is a familiar narrative that you're hearing from resorts across the country.
Yes, and just to build upon what Brent said, for our study for Utah in the last decade that we studied, we found 1 million fewer skier visits to the state and about $87 million in lost revenue. So that is something that I think we can expect to accelerate. And as Brent said, if we don't do anything with carbon pollution, we can expect it to be much worse than if we actually start to do something. And I really, it's good to think to switch the conversation a little bit about what we can do, because that's all we can do, right? We can do something. The broader, before I do that, what concerns me even more, and I love the ski industry, I'm a skier, it's great, and I've been to Utah to ski, there's other impacts that we've touched upon, which is the drought. And the one we had this year is a record drought, over 60% of the country affected. But most importantly, which really worries me, is that it's estimated that half of the actual growth in income that we've had, which is measured by gross domestic product, half of it is expected to be lost or canceled out from the impacts of the drought this year. And that's just one of many impacts. That's about $140 billion in equivalency. Sandy is estimated to be about $50 billion, that storm. But we have these record forest fires, record flooding, record extreme precipitation, many, many, many species, not just the polar bears, but species that much more directly will affect us, are seeing changes in their environment. And what we need to do is think about what we can do. And we actually have a lot of solutions. We also just put out a report last week looking at what the Environmental Protection Agency can do. Doesn't need Congress to do it. It actually has been, the Supreme Court has said twice that EPA has the authority to do it. And if it found a public health risk, that it actually has a legal obligation to do something about the emissions. And the largest source that we have right now is our power plants, our electricity system. And we can modernize that, and we proposed a way for EPA to do that would be very cost effective. In fact, electricity prices would marginally go down, and that's because energy efficiency, which is our cheapest by far resource to reduce our carbon pollution takes us there. Mm. We can also modernize our electricity system in terms of cleaner energy. And there's a number of different policies that we can certainly discuss to do that. But if we do that, then we can electrify our vehicles, which ultimately, it's about a third of our pollution, carbon pollution. But the good news there, and it's great that there's some good news here, is that the administration has actually done more to reduce carbon pollution than any of the combined presidents in the past. One of those ways in which it has done that is passed new fuel economy standards, which are going to halve the emissions from our new trucks and cars and increase the fuel efficiency and saving billions of dollars at the pump.
We're going to talk about the solutions, the possible policies out there that really could make a difference in this rather bleak outlook. We're speaking with Lori Johnson, Chief Economist at the Climate Center of the Natural Resources Defense Council. Also with us, Brent Giles. He's the Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation, which is the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort. And we're talking about climate change and the influence, the impact it's having on the economy. 801-355-TALK is our number. Let's go to the phones, and it looks like Brianne is joining us from Salt Lake City. Brianne, hi.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
So I was listening to the conversation, and we're talking about the economic impact of climate change and specifically the ski resorts. And I wondered if part of the decline in revenue in visits to the ski resort, it hasn't just been a reflection of partly of a bad economy.
Okay, Brianne. Lori, did you look at the larger economic slump that we're in and how that is affecting the industry as a whole?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And what we looked at was the lowest snowfall years and the highest in the last decade. And there's no pattern of all of them being during the recessionary period. Some of the high snowfall years were in very good economic years. Low snowfall years, we're in better times. So the bigger picture of these 35 states is there is not a specific, you know, we didn't look at just the recession years and just the regular years where the economy is functioning well. So that certainly has an impact just generally. You don't, recessions are going to decrease the demand for vacations and ski resort activities. But that doesn't drive our results.
Brent Giles, I mean, how much is this the slow economy affecting your bottom line at Powder Corporation, and how do you kind of reconcile the climate change part of this troubling picture?
Well, Jennifer and Brianne, that is a good question, but what really is the driver is snow. And a snow industry requires snow. And so if we have a lack of snow, we have a reduction in income. And so it doesn't matter if it's economy, if it's the economy's high, or if the economy's low. If there is a lack of snow, then that industry is reduced.
Brianne, are you a skier?
I am. That was a good point. I guess it's kind of supply and demand. Good snow, you know, drives the demand, I guess. As a skier, we want to be there. So that makes sense, I guess.
Brianne, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. I want to read part of a statement from the, let's see if I can find it, the National Ski Areas Association. They represent resorts across the nation. And in response to the Natural Resource Defense Council report, they issued this press release that says, ski areas are reducing their greenhouse gas emissions through significant investments in energy efficiency, renewable energy. Ski areas have not been on the sidelines when it comes to climate change. And Brent Giles, I'm curious, what has been happening in Powder Corporation? I mean, we talked about an increase of snowmaking. You're trying to compensate for the lack of precipitation and snow that's falling at the resorts. But what are you doing on the climate change part of it to curb gas greenhouse gases to become more energy efficient at the resort level?
Well, what the good story is that the reduction of carbon emissions, the conservation of energy, water, whatever the natural resources are, and saving money are inextricably linked. So the good story there is that everything we do in snowmaking, we look for the most efficient equipment we can get so that we can get maybe more production for less cost, which is less energy, which is less carbon. All of these things, like I said, are inextricably linked. Powder has spent over the past 7 years over $6 million in some of these initiatives, from purchasing wind power to purchasing more efficient snowmaking equipment, all of the lighting, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, all of those things that reduce our energy, reduces our carbon footprint. Plus, we've focused on education. We've focused on doing things like this show this morning, taking the opportunity to present to people to try to just keep going with telling them what they can do and need to do, and then advocating and working with NSAA. They're right. The ski areas haven't been sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. Doesn't mean that we can't do more. And NSAA, with their sustainable slopes that I think they started in 2000 or 2002, that program, and then last year, NSAA, National Ski Areas Association, started the Climate Challenge. Park City Mountain Resort was one of the founding members of the Climate Challenge, and that particular program, everyone that belongs to that reports their carbon footprint through NSAA. We all make a statement of a project we're going to do in the following year to reduce our carbon emissions, and then we advocate. It gives NSAA probably a little stronger arm to negotiate politically with more of us that are on board with that. All of Powder Resorts are members of that, and we hope that creates peer pressure as well with all the other ski areas.
As I mentioned, NSAA released a statement last week encouraging all of their guests to reduce automobile idling, to carpool to resorts, to purchase energy efficient household appliances, to buy green energy. It's something that resorts themselves are doing. Lori Johnson, a good start, not enough? What do you think?
It's definitely a good start. I wish that the ski resorts could solve the whole problem on their own, but they certainly can't, and the rest of society has to step up and participate and do its share. It's not a problem that can be solved by one particular industry or one particular individual. It has to be something that we commit to politically and take the actions that they absolutely have to do, because the cost of doing nothing is very, very severe. And some may say, oh, well, you know, you cannot have more electricity, you can't have it cost more. But there's a couple of responses to that, which is it doesn't necessarily need to cost more because we have a lot of different options. The amount that it might cost, if it's a little bit more, can certainly be offset with public policies that help energy consumers, in terms of just making energy cheaper, and that's something we know how to do. We can do that. So the costs that might be entailed are so much less than the cost of doing nothing. And I would even add to that doing these things have a number of benefits, not just saving money from energy efficiency, but tens of thousands of people die every year from burning fossil fuels, the pollution that puts in the air. And there's very, very large public health costs to that. There's also very, very large environmental costs to our extraction of coal, natural gas, oil, which, as we've seen with the Gulf spill, can threaten thousands and thousands of jobs. with the tourism industry there, fishing. It's just been a disaster, very devastating to the people who live there. So the equation of jobs and higher energy costs leaves out a lot of different jobs that are many, many jobs, including farmers, and that are threatened. And it doesn't look at the fact that when we do take action, we are creating a lot of jobs. It's just kind of, what kind of jobs do we want to create? We can create 19th century dirty energy jobs, or we can create cleaner, better ways of getting our energy that creates different kinds of jobs. And adding to that, there's a democratization of energy that can happen in terms of moving away from all utility scale to actually putting solar panels on people's roofs, letting farmers rent out a very small part of their land while they can still farm. They can earn about $8,000 a wind turbine and still do their farming. And that really, you know, if it gets to that level, I think people will see that there's just a number of benefits we can get that are we shouldn't lose sight of those. Hmm. Because what often happens in Congress and the whole debate and the money that is spent by the fossil fuel lobby is a scare tactic. And it says, oh, we're just going to ruin the economy, we're going to kill all these jobs. And it's just not accurate.
How is the low snowpack affecting marketing efforts of the resorts? You're the chief sustainability officer, so maybe you can't answer this question, but I mean, when we tout ourselves as having the greatest snow on Earth, can we continue to say that in the face of reports like this one? Brent Giles?
You're right. I'm not the marketing guy, me and marketing speak two different languages entirely.
Maybe it's an unfair question. Well, what I mean,
but you know, in reality is that between now and 2030, we're probably not going to see a whole lot of big changes. You know, we may see a week or so cut off at the beginning of the season, and maybe the same off the back end of the season. That's a big problem for me because that story says, well, then we don't have to do anything, right? Mm. I don't have to worry about it until 2030, and that's exactly the wrong message. But we'll still have good snow. We'll still have good powder between now and then, although what we have seen is it's starting to get wetter. The snow that we're starting to get has more water content in it. Avalanche patterns are changing. So we're seeing these changes. We're not, and so we market, okay, we still got good snow. Come on, enjoy it, you know. What we need to do is market the other piece of that as well. And this is what you need to do, what we need to do, what we're doing to try to protect it. Because everybody wants to have that lifestyle for 100 years.
But the resorts, I guess the overriding message from both of you is the resorts can't do it alone. It has to be a collective effort, and it has to be at the macro level, I guess. And when you hear about UN officials who met in Doha over the weekend agreeing to extend the Kyoto Protocols, which is that agreement to curb greenhouse gas emissions from the industrialized world, they're not quite ready to extend those standards to the developing nations. I mean, how can you get everybody on the planet on board on this critical issue? Brent, what do you...
Well, that is a problem. I happen to believe that we're going to have to pay. If we don't pay for something, it doesn't cost us enough. We seem to ignore it. The problem I have with that is, as you mentioned, is poverty. Because if you're trying to choose between a loaf of bread or a CFL, that's not a very good choice. And so that's where we need to be able to have politics, laws, that can help us reduce this carbon footprint. And we need to be able to go to some of these underdeveloped countries and help them with developing a different type of renewable energy that will create jobs for them and solve some of the energy problems, some of that poverty level at the same time.
Lori Johnson, just about a minute left. How do you get, how do you convince leaders of the world, members of every community in this nation to take climate change seriously?
I think actually Mother Nature is doing that for us. That is the most powerful message. And these extreme weather events and changes have happened everywhere. No area has been spared. To build on what Brent has just said, we have to take the lead. We have markets that are very, very innovative. We have research universities. We have a large infrastructure. So we really have to take the lead before these other countries are going to make a commitment. Because remember, we also created the entire amount that's there now. And the poverty, it's right. People are not going to choose to do emissions reductions if the choice is hunger instead. So that can't be solved, and the developed nations are just going to have to step up and take a lead role and create. We want to do that because that will benefit our markets, not just dealing with the poverty of those countries. Yeah, it will cost us something up front, but we have so much wealth precisely because we've burned all these fossil fuels that we have the means and the markets and the moral responsibility to take the lead. And I think countries are waiting for us to do that. And once they see us do that, and they have some technologies that can more and more be deployed, they will come on board.
Lori Johnson, she is chief economist at the Climate Center for the Natural Resources Defense Council, which issued this report on climate change and the economy in the winter sports industry. Lori Johnson, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Brent Giles, Chief Sustainability Officer for Powder Corporation, the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort and 8 other resorts throughout the country. Brent, great to have you. Thank you so much for your time as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll put some links up to the National Resources Defense Council report on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, we continue our discussion of winter, but we're going to add spring and summer and fall, Vivaldi style. But first a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. For the 30th year, musicians will perform Vivaldi's classical standard, The Four Seasons, by candlelight. And today on the program, we're discussing the enduring appeal of these beloved Baroque pieces and the genius behind them. Joining me in studio is Gerald Elias. He's a familiar voice here at KCPW, a former violinist with the Boston Symphony and former associate concertmaster of the Utah Symphony. He's performed extensively as a violinist and conductor, and his compositions have been performed throughout the United States. Since 2004, he's also been the music director of the Vivaldi by Candlelight concert series here in Salt Lake City, and not to mention an award-winning mystery writer. Jerry, it's great to have you in studio again. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks. Nice to be back, Jennifer.
And David Cowley is also joining us. He's the principal oboist of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and one of the leading oboists in Great Britain. He's very well known to BBC television, radio, and internet audiences around the world. He's also a professor of the oboe at the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama, and he's performing in the annual Vivaldi by Candlelight this year. David, welcome. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
The 30th annual Vivaldi by Candlelight benefit concert will be held this Saturday, December 15th at 8 o'clock here in Salt Lake City. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, if you're a Vivaldi fan, what do you want to know about this composer and about the performance by Candlelight? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Before we get to the music, how did the two of you guys get together? Gerald Elias, you've known David for a number of years?
Yeah, since about 1980, in fact. We had a mutual friend, and I was on a Boston Symphony tour to England at the time, and I was introduced to David, and The rest is history.
The rest is history. Introduce us to Vivaldi. He was born in Venice in the late 17th century, but he started out thinking he was going to be a priest, right?
Mm-hmm. Actually, he was officially a priest, though his liturgical duties were secondary to his composing and his music making. And he conducted an orchestra of, it was called Orphan Girls, but in fact they were, it was almost like a little university for women in Venice. And he was there for decades and composed almost all of his great concertos for those girls.
He was such a prolific composer. Mm-hmm. He composed so many operas and other works, and has been performed for the last 300, 400 years.
Well, he certainly has become one of our most popular composers, and of his compositions, The Four Seasons, I think, is just one of the most universally beloved sets of concertos that we have in the world.
What's the appeal? What's the enduring appeal of Vivaldi?
Well, in general, it's his melodic and rhythmic invention that it's just really engaging. But I think for these concertos, I mean, just his description of things, musical descriptions of things, everything from cracking ice to hunters to drunken peasants, to dying hares. You know, it's just wonderfully imaginative, and plus all the other great things that go along with Vivaldi.
David Cowley, I mean, what do you see as Vivaldi's place in Baroque music?
Well, he's undoubtedly one of the most important figures from that era. His appeal and his enduring appeal is on a par with that of J.S. Bach, who's the other composer that we'll be playing during the concert.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the pieces that you'll be performing.
Well, I'm performing in two pieces in the first half of the concert, or the first part of the concert. One is the concerto by Johann Sebastian Bach for oboe and violin, which I'll be playing with Jerry. And that's, in fact, the piece that we played together many years ago when we first met, just for fun. And we said at the time, wouldn't it be nice if we could do this in the concert someday? And here we are. Finally made it happen.
Here you are.
Yeah.
It took that long to get you to
That's
town.
That's right. Yeah.
David Cowley, he is the principal oboist of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and he's performing as part of the 30th annual Vivaldi by Candlelight benefit concert being held this Saturday, December 15th at 8 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church. That's at 12 C Street. The intersection is South Temple here in Salt Lake City, and the proceeds will benefit the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. If you'd like to join us, if you've gone to the Candlelight Concert in the past, what keeps you going back? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Gerald Elias, why do you like to play Vivaldi as a violinist? I mean, what's the challenge there?
Well, we were just talking about this before we came here. Which is that compared to the general orchestral repertoire, which calls for 80 to 100 musicians, playing Baroque music, especially Vivaldi, there's a certain clarity and energy about it that is very refreshing and revitalizing. And I think it's the same for audience as well. Of course, it's great to hear a Tchaikovsky or a Brahms symphony, but every once in a while you need that different course, which kind of clarifies your brain and clarifies your soul. So I think that's the wonderful thing about Baroque music and Vivaldi.
For those, I can't imagine anyone not being familiar with the Four Seasons, but mm-hmm. I mean, describe these four distinct pieces. What was Vivaldi trying to accomplish in these, Gerald Elias?
Well, here's sort of a bonus at the concert. Vivaldi wrote sonnets for each of these concertos, and you've just heard David's impeccable English accent. We're going to have David read the sonnets during the course of the performance so that the audience can hear exactly what Vivaldi had in mind when he wrote the compositions. It's there are four concertos for violin, spring, summer, fall, and winter, and there's sort of a a dramatic continuity from one to the other that one doesn't normally hear at a performance because of the kind of performance practice we have these days. But so this is going to be a little experiment. I think it's going to be quite a nice adventure to have both the sonnets and the music being performed.
Oh, that sounds lovely. This is a recorded piece by Seiji Ozawa mm-hmm. from the Boston Symphony
Orchestra.
Your former boss. A recording of... Shall we listen to Winter first or summer?
Sure, let's do Winter.
Let's do Winter. This is an Allegro piece performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Very familiar piece of Vivaldi's Winter, part of the Four Seasons that you'll be playing this Saturday night. And as we were comparing notes, you said that had to do with icicles. What? Mm-hmm. But tell me the imagery that you feel that you see when you play this, Gerald Elias.
Well, it's not just my imagery. It's Vivaldi's. He talks about that opening that we heard as being people kind of walking very tentatively on ice in the frigid middle of winter, and then they continue along the ice and worry about it breaking, and the wind comes up and the snow starts to buzz around them, and the slow movement, which is one of the most beautiful melodies he ever wrote, takes place inside the home where they're sitting indoors and they're watching the rain and snow beat against the window while the violin plays this beautiful melody because they're sitting by the fireplace. So it's really unique what Vivaldi did here to create musical images of the visual.
David Cowley, candlelight. It's kind of the original mood lighting. What's it like to play the oboe by candlelight?
Well, I'm hoping that there'll be a little bit of electrical assistance somewhere along the way for me. So I'll be able to see what I'm playing. But it's going to create a very evocative, very magical atmosphere.
This is the 30th anniversary of mm-hmm. the Vivaldi by Candlelight
yes.
concert series. As I mentioned, you've been on since 2004 as the music director. What got this tradition started?
Well, I think it was all an effort to support this wonderful organization, the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy, which has been going on longer than that. And at one point, the director of that organization had gone to Europe and had seen a concert of this type at a church in Europe and said, oh, wouldn't this make a great fundraiser for our organization here in Salt Lake City? And the tradition started with Rick Linobis, who was the first music director 30 years ago, and he passed the baton off to Barbara Scowcroft, who did it for a number of years, and I, in turn, have succeeded her, and this is my ninth year doing it, and I have to tell you, it is the most enjoyable concert of the year for me, so I can't wait.
Can you still get tickets?
You can still get tickets. You can either go to the website of the UCCD, which is utahdiplomacy.org, or you can call their director of communications, Katie Clark, and her number is 801-832-3272.
We'll put that on our website as well.
That'd be great. And, you know, there are also a number of sponsorship opportunities for this concert, starting at $250, which includes not only tickets to the concert, but a wonderful, elegant pre-concert dinner that I've been to, so I can attest to that, and also a signed copy of my latest book, which, Jennifer, you and I talked about last spring.
We surely did. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a wonderful evening. The 30th annual Vivaldi by Candlelight Benefit Concert will be held this Saturday, December 15th at 8 o'clock at the First Presbyterian Church. That's on 12 C Street here in Salt Lake City. And, of course, proceeds will benefit the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. You'll have more information at kcpw.org. Gerald Elias, David Cowley, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, Fear of the Queer Child, a discussion about perceptions of exposing children to homosexuality. So join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.